Hi folks, welcome to episode 94 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about attempts to climb Mount Everest, because it's been there forever, and so people have looked at it for a long time and gone, I could get up the top of that. And a lot of people haven't.
Yeah, a lot of dead bodies on Everest. A lot of people have died. Over 200 people have died trying to climb Everest.
So this is kind of a follow-up to the Antarctic adventures we were covering. Just because this is another extreme thing that people have done. And I don't know much about it, to be honest.
Well, I've been absolutely fascinated with it since I can remember. We're just about old enough to have our childhoods in the era before the internet, right?
Yeah.
I remember going to the library, an actual physical library, when I was a kid, when I was about 12 or something, or 13 or something, and going to get a book about Everest and reading about Sir Ed.
I used to read books Edmund of Hillary. Greek mythology in the library, just because it was fascinating.
And I love mountains. I don't know about you, but I love being among mountains. I really love it. I'm not a mountaineer. I've never climbed a mountain with crampons and clip-on ropes or anything like that.
I've walked up Everest and Snowdon. Snowdon's actually a lot more difficult than Everest. Not Everest. Ben Nevis, right. Not Everest. In fact, it depends, actually. There are like multiple routes up these mountains. And I went on the Crib Goch one on Snowdon, which is the dangerous one, frankly. And that involves some actual climbing. And then the Ben Nevis one, it's rough, but it's like, it's more an endurance test to go up the sort of, you go around the back of Ben Nevis and it's just basically fallen rock that you have to scramble up. So it's not really a climb, but it is quite fun to do, but it's also very tiring.
The Ben is like no joke. No. Well, I say that compared to the Himalayas.
Well, yeah, compared to the Himalayas, it's nothing, obviously.
You say Everest has been around forever, just to mention. It's the youngest mountain range in the world.
Sure, but then that makes it only like 40 million years old.
Another quick thing to mention right off the bat, which is very interesting, is that up on the higher Tibetan plateau and in the Himalayas, there's ammonites and ancient fossils of sea creatures. You can believe that.
I can.
At the top of Everest.
I know how the Himalayas were formed. But for anyone who doesn't know, the Indian subcontinent is on a different continental shelf or something.
And Tectonic plate.
And it's travelled up from Antarctica and crashed into Asia. And the continual process of it crashing into Asia is what has created the Himalayas. So at one point, they were the bottom of a seabed. So it must have been quite a surprise for them, though.
Particularly the Tibetan side, because where they hit, and like the Indian plate is going under and it's pushing the Asian plate upwards. That's fascinating to know. I just love being among the mountains. I've been to the Rockies, sort of the Colorado Rockies and the Alps, all different places in the French and Italian Alps. And although I haven't got like a burning passion to summit the peaks.
Yeah.
I just love being among it.
It is a nice environment. I went to, Andorra in the Pyrenees? I think it's Andorra. Like it was just basically a ski holiday for a friend's bachelor party, basically. It was fun. You know, I hate skiing, but like it's a nice place and it's interesting to go to. And there's beautiful scenery.
And the Apennine Mountains. I've been all over Italy. So the Apennine Mountains that run down the middle of Italy. I don't know. It's a bit weird, maybe. Well, lots of people say it, but I just feel some sort of peace when I'm surrounded by higher mountains. I just really like it.
Fair enough.
And so anyway, ever since I was young, been fascinated by Everest. Again, haven't got like that burning passion to climb it, but just absolutely fascinated by it, like weirdly fascinated by it, like a magpie and something shiny. I think lots of people feel that way about it. It's obvious it's the roof of the world. It's the highest point in the world. There's something, I think especially boys, you're fascinated by the fastest thing that there ever was. The lowest point of the ocean, the highest mountain, the coldest place, the hottest
extremity
place.
Of it.
And so you're just sort of drawn to it. To the point where there's one of the most legendary Sherpas, a guy called, he died actually in the Himalayas, climbing, fell into a crevasse. His name, by the name of Babuchiri Sherpa.
Right.
And he had a record. He's still got the record for the longest time ever spent on the summit. And I think he did have the world record for the fastest ascent. I think it's been broken now. Right. He died in like 2000, 2001 in Exton. Anyway, I started the Wikipedia page on that back in 2006 when Wiki was quite new. And I just checked this morning to see if you can still see that my name's attached to that page, and it is.
Oh, well.
So it just goes to show that I have, in fact, been fascinated by Everest.
I don't think anyone was doubting you.
And, so it's a privilege, really, to be telling these stories. I feel extraordinary privileged. And, I want to thank you for the opportunity for doing this, because it's...
I'm glad you're here, man.
It really is, because a lot of people know all these stories, and I'm going over stuff. But sometimes when you get comments saying, I've never heard of... Like the Battle of Cressy. Yeah. I've never heard of Shackleton.
Hmm.
And little old me gets to bring it to these people. I feel extremely privileged. So where a lot of people probably know this stuff, if you're interested in Everest, for those that don't, I hope I can do it some justice. So the story, the main story, although I'm going to talk all about it in all sorts of ways, is the first ascent, the primacy. That's the main thing, isn't it? Loads of people know about Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong. Nobody cares about Apollo 16.
No.
Right. So the headline of that is that there's the official story, the guy that first summited, Sir Edmund Hillary, a Kiwi, Sir Ed, and Tenzing Sherpa, in 1953.
Really? So, I mean, the Tibetan culture is ancient, none of them went and did it.
Apparently not. Apparently not. They don't claim they ever did.
Weird.
Mm.
Okay.
Well, it's technically extremely difficult.
Well, I bet it is, yeah.
You can do it without oxygen. And in fact, people nowadays make a point of doing it, some extreme people. But most human beings, nearly all human beings, you need bottled oxygen to really do it.
But I take it Sir Edmund Hillary didn't have that.
No, he did.
Oh, did he?
They did. Okay, so the first thing to mention is that the Mount Everest is right on the border between Nepal and Tibet. And I'm going to call it Tibet, not China.
That's not very controversial.
Because screw the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah. Not a terribly controversial thing.
I'm going to call it Tibet. But technically it is actually China. Sometimes they just say the Chinese side. So there's the Nepalese side and the Tibetan side, the north side and the south side. And it can be climbed from either side. And they're very different experiences.
Right, okay.
They're very different routes. There's actually multiple routes it's possible to climb Everest. But there's one, the main one is from the Nepalese side. If you were going to spend money and go on some extreme adventure tourist company to take you up, you would go to Nepal and climb the Nepalese side.
I'll let Callum know.
All right, yeah. And normal people can do it. That is one thing to say. I have heard it said, and this is an exaggeration. However, I have heard it said that if the conditions are just perfect and all your guides and Sherpas are top-notch, sort of anyone can do it within reason. So not anyone, as long as you're fit.
Sure.
Sort of anyone can do it. Like, we'll put it this way, it's not technically difficult. There's a couple of technical bits, but again, your Sherpas will put ropes in place. So, for example, K2, the second highest peak in the world, is technically very difficult. You're going to need to be sort of an expert mountaineer to have a shot at that. Whereas Everest, surprisingly, if everything lines up right for you, but the thing is, the likelihood of that happening is quite small.
Right.
Because the weather...
I can't imagine the weather's very good.
Just like we were saying in Antarctica, the weather changes on a dime.
Hmm.
And so that's how a lot of people die. Is that the day is a perfect day, and 5 minutes later you're in a storm, and you die of exposure out on there. So lots of people have summited it now, like over 1,000, well over 1,000.
Right.
So these days, in the last few years, sometimes there'll be a queue to summit. It's mad, right? It's absolutely mad compared to the stories I'm going to tell about the pioneers.
Yeah.
It's almost unbelievable.
Right, okay.
But yeah, a few hundred people have died trying. About a third of them Sherpas as well.
Right.
Sherpas are not immune,
of course.
Although they are the best. They're genetically, it's proven genetically, great for high altitude.
Well, I mean, if you spend thousands of years living at the top of the roof of the world, of course it's going to change you.
So I'd like to say a few words about the Sherpa people, first and foremost. The best ones, the ones that get employed to be helpers, are just unbelievable. Like the best mountaineers in the world sort of can't believe what they do.
Okay.
The amounts they carry.
Right.
Like the best mountaineers in the world from America or Switzerland or France or wherever are like struggling up and there's a Sherpa with 80 pounds on his back sort of walking up it.
But this is what happens when you're raised in a particular environment,
yeah.
right? You know, become that thing.
So the Sherpa people inhabit the land on both the Nepalese side and the Tibetan side. The story goes that originally they were sort of Tibetan people, and in a long, long ago, in sort of prehistory times, they migrated round and started living on the what is now the Nepalese side.
Right.
So they're the same sorts of people, same ethnicities. There's four different tribes, is not the word, but basically...
cultures.
And it gets a bit more complicated than that because Nepal is, as you can imagine, I'll put maps up so people can see, closely associated with India. Mm. And the Tibetans are obviously, fairly obviously, closely associated with China. Mm. I think ethnically they're sort of a bit more Mongol than anything else.
Okay.
Anyway, their ability for their blood to hold oxygen, and that's what it's all about, if your platelets in your blood can hold oxygen well or not.
Yeah.
And just being endlessly acclimatized from birth to live, being born at 6,000 meters, you know, and living maybe not quite that much, 3,000 meters.
But we're about 30 meters, you know, so.
Yeah, we're pretty much at sea level.
Yeah.
I mean.
We're in the southwest of England.
More or less sea level, yeah. So, for example, most... people from Western people, or most people in the world don't have to be Western. When you're in what they call the death zone, which is over 8,000 meters, you're just dying the whole time. You're basically dying of hypoxia, especially if you don't have oxygen. You're not meant to live up there.
Well, yeah.
Because there's so little oxygen in the air.
Yeah.
Normal amount of oxygen in the air is about 20, 21%. And up there, it sort of can be 8% or lower.
Right.
So, doesn't matter how hard you breathe or how much you breathe, you're not getting enough oxygen.
Yeah.
And so your brain and your gut and all sorts of things start to shut down. Might be slowly, might not be slowly. Whereas they can do it. Babu Chiri Sherpa, one of my heroes, spent 21 hours on the summit of Everest. Most people, you're up there, you have a quick 5 minutes to take a picture.
Yeah.
And you head back down as quickly as you can. He spent 21 hours up there. That's
mad.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's absolutely unbelievable. I'm not sure.
Wait, 21 hours.
I think he must have done that time.
Yeah.
But lots of, fair few Sherpas do it without oxygen.
Right.
And then you get like you get the odd superhuman. I mean that in sort of a literal sense where they're sort of a genetic freak.
Yeah.
Some people can do it.
Right.
Okay. Can climb it without oxygen, but it's extremely rare. Extremely rare.
If you're wondering, you're probably not that person.
Yeah, probably not. Babu Chiri Sherpa in the 90s climbed Everest from base camp to summit in just under 17 hours.
And how far is that?
Well, it usually takes a whole season to do it,
right,
to acclimatize. And it certainly takes days and days and days for a normal person to do it. So to sort of jog up Everest...
Matt.
Alpine style in one go. Unbelievable. I think that record has been broken now by another Sherpa.
Right. Okay.
But so it just goes to show that the Sherpa people,
you
can't give them enough credit, really.
Well, I mean, they're designed by nature to do it, right?
And they're Buddhist. Their religion is Buddhism. And there's different strains of Buddhism, but their particular strain, and runs through a lot of Buddhism, is sort of selflessness. And so they see it as almost like a religious responsibility to help people up and down.
That's right.
It's not just for money. It's not just to be nice. It's sort of their duty in a way. And they realise it's other people's dream. It's their dream to try and climb Everest. Mm. And they're obliged to help them.
That's nice.
It's really, really nice. Their attitude is just unbelievably good.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I wanted to say that. I've got a... endless respect for the Sherpa people. Okay, so the Britons and Kiwis, and I'll get to it why that is, but particularly Britons have got a sort of a special relationship with Everest.
Yeah, I bet we do. Stupid relationship. Oh, look, there's something stupid. Let's go and climb it.
Yeah.
oh, look, there's Antarctica. Let's go and travel it. Yeah, we do stupid things.
Because the reason it's called Everest is because in the 1850s, where the Raj, where the British Empire controlled India, we went and surveyed. We surveyed most of the world back in the Victorian period.
Just for the fun of
it. And it was at that point that we realised that that was the highest peak.
Right.
Or at that point, it was certainly the highest peak, and it's never been broken. And now we've mapped the whole world, we realise it is, in fact, the highest peak.
Right.
And the leader of the of that survey was called Everest. His surname was Everest, so we called it Everest. But of course, the people of the region have got their own words for them. I won't try to butcher them. But the Nepalese, the Tibetans, the Chinese have each got their own word for it.
Yeah, of course.
But the Sherpas refer to it in translation, of course, as like a mother goddess, a mother goddess of the earth. That's how they view it, and they have sort of endless respect for it. There's lots all over the Everest region on both sides. There's lots of prayer wheels.
But if you don't respect it, it'll kill you.
Yeah.
That's the thing, isn't it?
That's another thing to state the obvious is that if you take your eye off the ball for a moment, it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
There are dangerous mountains in the world, and there are treacherous mountains in the world. And I say Everest isn't technically all that difficult, but it's a killer. It's a real, real killer. There's another peak nearby called Island Peak, which again is a bit like Snowdon or Kilimanjaro. You can walk up it.
Right.
Kilimanjaro, anyone can, within reason.
Yeah. It is very high, though. A friend of mine climbed Kilimanjaro.
It's the highest peak in Africa.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently it's very... The climb is just a walk.
Yeah.
But it's the like breathlessness you get of it and the lightheadedness and the altitude changes. What they do to your body is the issue.
Altitude sickness is a bitch.
Yeah.
A real bitch. And I actually, I once climbed Vesuvius in the Bay of Naples, which isn't high at all.
No?
No. Well, it's right by the sea.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not high at all.
Yeah.
And I got headache. I got a terrible headache.
Yeah.
I thought my head was going to blow up. It was quite bad.
I was quite lucky with climbing like Ben Nevis and... Snowdon. I didn't feel any ill effects. I was just tired because it was a long trip. You know, it's a long walk.
Yeah, my body isn't equipped to deal with high altitude particularly, which is really disappointing to me. Because again, as a younger man,
I'd like to die on Everest.
I had a pipe dream of going there one day.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, in my 20s, I did seriously look at flying to Kathmandu and hiking to base camp, like no intention of actually going up Everest, but just trying to get to base camp and stuff. It was not going to happen for me now, but I did have a pipe dream of it when I was younger. And I would love it. I mean, I do like hill climbing, you know, I love the Brecon Beacons. Walking all over the beacons is great. But yeah, when I climbed Vesuvius, I realized that physiologically I'm not cut out for it. Because it was terrible. I got to the top of Vesuvius, but my headache was so bad that maybe if I acclimatized, because acclimatization is the whole thing, but I'm not a natural, unfortunately. I was quite gutted about that, sort of on a personal level, I realized that. But, well, there you go. There you go. There's a story that Brian Blessed, who obviously is sort of an old, overweight man, He did a little documentary, went to the Everest region, and his genetics are very, very good for high altitude. Like his blood, his ability for his blood to hold oxygen is very, very high. So though he's clearly out of shape, he actually did better than the young people that were in his filming crew and stuff.
Right, right.
So there is a genetic element to it, a very real element to it. But you can, of course, train for it.
Yeah.
Of course. All right, so we first called it Everest back in the 1850s, but we realised that no one back then really had any dreams of trying to climb it because it's sort of obviously stupidly difficult. It's just sort of a no-go thing.
Well, why would you bother?
All right. Yeah.
It's insanely dangerous.
Yeah. Where I mentioned that the official story is that Sir Edmund Hillary, in 1953, the news got back to England on Coronation Day.
Oh, really? Queen
Victoria II's Coronation Day in 1953, that it had been conquered. But there's another claim much earlier in 1924 that
not by called, a Norwegian, is it?
No, by an Englishman, of course.
Okay.
George Mallory, right. A chap called George Mallory, in mountaineering circles, a legend, absolute legend. And he died on the mountain.
Right.
But some think that maybe he summited.
And what, died on the way back?
Maybe. Hmm. Well, I'll tell you the story.
Yeah, okay.
We'll go into the story of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, just after World War I, people decided, or Brits, rather, decided we're going to try and climb it.
Yeah.
Because it's there to be done. And that is a Mallory line.
Hmm.
Because it's there is the line. When people said, why? So they sent an expedition out in 1921 and then another one in 1922. And the one in 1922 was a serious, the first one was really sort of a reconnoiter type deal. Yeah. And in 1922, they tried to climb it. Mallory was in that. And they failed. And he wrote a whole book about it. You can find that on audiobook in full on YouTube, a LibriVox recording in the public domain. And it's a fascinating book, great book.
Yeah.
Love it, absolutely love it. And in that, because Mallory died and he's sort of a tragic figure, that book, you get to hear Mallory's words all about what it's like. Mm. But they failed. Another one in 1923, which also failed. But then 1924 is the famous one where they started getting really serious about it. They realised they had a bit of experience. They realised what it was like. They realised what they would need. They need really light boots. You don't need really durable boots. You want really light boots, things like that.
Hmm.
It was sort of a first proper serious attempt with a little bit of knowledge of what they were in for in 1924. And a bit like in the Antarctic expeditions, you'd set up camps along the way. And you'd make like a higher camp fairly near the summit and then get everything ready for this final push to the summit and back. Hmm. And they did all that sort of stuff. And, well, the last push was just two people, Andrew Irvine and George Mallory. George Mallory was sort of he was relatively old, not that old in today's terms, but he was like in his late 30s. I think he was like 37, something like that.
Right.
But he was very, very experienced. He was sort of Mr. Everest. But Andrew Irvine was pretty much a novice and he was younger. He was in his 20s and extraordinarily fit, apparently. He was like a rowing champion.
Right.
And he was handpicked by Mallory to do this final attempt. And they head up from what was then, I think they called it Camp 6, to the summit and were never seen again.
Oh.
They disappeared. And it's one of those things that was a bit of a mystery. Well, it was a true mystery. I remember having another book when I was a kid. It was like the mysteries from history. So like the Mary Celeste, who shot JFK, what happened to Mallory? It was like a mystery. It's been solved now, by the way, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But for the longest time, he just disappeared.
I'm guessing he fell down a crevasse.
Yeah, it wasn't a crevasse, but
yeah.
Well, we don't know exactly what happened to him, but I'll tell you what happens in a minute. When he was asked, why do this ridiculously dangerous thing? He just said, because it is there.
Hmm.
Famous line, brilliant line.
Yeah. Sort of Victorian indomitable spirit there.
Well, it says in that book, that 1922 book, and other people said, we're in the tradition of the old colonialists.
Mm.
We can do anything and we bally well will.
Mm.
No? And we've just survived, our generation has just survived the war, World War I. We laugh in the face of death. We drop ice cubes down the vest of fear.
don't make men like that anymore, do we?
Right, yeah, yeah. True contempt for danger.
Hmm.
Bring it on.
Hmm.
Dial it up.
Hmm.
Yeah. Hardy, hardy men.
Hmm.
He wrote a letter to his wife on that June 1924 expedition. And he said, because they knew it was a ridiculous ask still. Even though they're going to throw everything at it. He wrote, quote, it's 50 to 1 against us, but we'll have a whack yet and do ourselves proud. It's great Scott Shackleton's type stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
He also wrote, this time to a friend, quote, we're going to sail to the top this time and God with us, or stamp to the top with our teeth in the wind.
I approve of the attitude.
I love it. Mm. I absolutely love it. Mm. They realised even then that they probably should have some oxygen. Probably a good idea. But again, it's like the 20s. Yeah. So it was really, really, really primitive technology to
I'm
do
amazed
that.
They could get bottled oxygen in the 20s.
Right.
I didn't even realise. I assumed they couldn't.
And even to this day, actually not to this day, because this day we do everything really quite in a sophisticated way. But even in the 1950s, when they went up, your bottled oxygen was like a precarious, dodgy bit of kit. It may or may not work. It may just quit on you at any moment. Or even, in fact, in the 1990s, it was still a bit touch and go.
Right, okay.
You couldn't just absolutely rely on your oxygen
equipment,
your gear, your rig, to just definitely work perfectly for you. So in the 20s, it was cutting-edge stuff. Mm. And Andrew Irvine wrote back to a friend, and he was a bit of an engineer. That was another reason why Mallory picked him, because he was a bit of an expert in this stuff. It was sort of his wheelhouse was the oxygen kit and stuff. Anyway, he wrote back to a friend saying, quote, "The oxygen apparatus has already been boggled, i.e. compromised.
Yeah.
They haven't taken my design, but what they have sent is hopeless. It breaks if you touch it, leaks, is ridiculously clumsy and heavy. Out of 90 cylinders, 15 were empty and 24 leaked badly by the time they got to Calcutta. Egads, I broke one today, taking it out of its packing case."
Right.
So there you go. So they get up to sort of a very high camp. You have to make many stages. And in fact, just to mention, they were coming from the Tibetan side, which is nowadays the less favoured side, although people still climb it from that side all the time. It's a great documentary on YouTube, actually, about an American guy doing precisely that. But usually you come from the Nepal side these days. They were coming from the Tibetan side. One of the guys they had with them was a chap called Noel O'Dell, and he was up there in that high, he never tried to summit, but he was up there at that high camp with them. And he was a bit of a geologist. He cared more about the geology than summiting. All sorts of people got all the different motivations. And his account of what happened, he was the last one seeing them alive.
Right.
See? And so his account, he lived to be extremely old. There's interviews with him from like the 1980s. Extremely old 90-year-old talking about it. Incredible. Incredible guy. He said, after they went out that day in May 1924, he said, quote, "I noticed far away on a snow slope leading up to what seemed to me to be the last step but one from the base of the final pyramid," meaning the very, very top. They call it the pyramid, the final pyramid. "He noticed a tiny object moving and approaching a rock step. A second object followed, and then the first climbed to the top. As I stood watching this dramatic appearance, the scene became enveloped in cloud once more," end quote. And that's it. They were never seen again. And some say they probably did summit because they were sort of ridiculously determined to do that. And others
say, but if you can't prove it.
Right, yeah. So that's the thing. You can't prove it one way or another.
Yeah.
And Andrew Irvine's body to this day has never been found.
Right.
What happened to him, we don't know. Because when you're up there, regardless of if you come from Tibet or Nepal, what you actually do is you climb some of the false summits very nearby and then walk along a ridge, either the northeast ridge or the southwest running ridge, to summit. And those ridges, it's like a knife edge ridge, and there's like a 2,500 meter drop one side and a 3,500 meter drop the other side. And there's another much more dangerous place on the mountain I'll talk about later, but the second most dangerous place is that. The place where second most people die is falling off that.
Yeah.
They call it taking the grand tour. If you fall off.
I bet it's a remarkable view. Seconds.
Well, they say kind of obviously the view from up there, because you're above the clouds.
Yeah.
You're way above the clouds, actually. They say the view is Well, there's plenty of footage of it.
Yeah, I guess we'll put some up.
Yeah. And you can see all the other great peaks because there's a mountain. All the highest peaks in the world, like over the top 100, are all in the Himalaya region, or some on the border with China and Pakistan. They're all there, basically. Yeah. One of the mountains directly next to Everest, it basically looks like another part of Everest, is Lhotse. And that's the fourth highest peak in the world.
Right.
And you basically climb most of Lhotse and then head across a ridge and then summit Everest. That's basically how you do it if you're approaching from the Nepalese side anyway. That knife edge ridge, I mean, it's terrifying.
I can believe it.
I love mountains and I'm fascinated by Everest, but I don't think I've got the guts to do it. Even if I was sort of carried up there by a Sherpa and then they said, now you've got to walk across that ridge. I don't think I've got the balls, if I'm perfectly honest. It looks terrifying.
I bet it is.
Yeah, it looks terrifying.
I'm not doing it, you know.
Yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.